Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Deep Creek Anglican Church.
Researchers make a distinction between what's called maximizers and satisficers. Maximizers always aim to make the best possible choice, and satisficers tend to aim for good enough, whether or not better selections might be out there. I think I'm a maximizer. Let me explain by talking you through some choices I've made in the last few years to do with study and work. I'm sometimes astonished by my own laziness. I'm a serial procrastinator and usually only get things done right in the nick of time before they're meant to get done, like this sermon, for example. I almost always need the pressure of a deadline to focus my motivation and energy on a task. When thinking about this more broadly and not in terms of day-to-day or week-to-week deadlines and commitments, but for example in terms of work and career directions, I think I've approached these in a similar way. In other words, I struggle to do things that I see little or no reason for doing. When I have the choice to do one of several things, I'll usually try to choose the option that I think's the very best. I'm a maximizer. Now, you can't really read that, but this is from an article that I found on the tyranny of choice and choice in our world and how it's become often very complicated and hard to make decisions on everyday matters. So these are some examples of choices that we're faced, you know, from time to time. Probably too small to read, but I'll read out a couple that I think are probably maybe common for us. So, you know, this scale was designed for people to try and work out themselves if they were either a maximizer or a satisficer. So these are a series of 13 questions, and you're meant to go through them and sort of rate yourself from 1 to 7 based on whether you're likely to agree or disagree with each statement. So, for example, you know, when I'm in the car and the radio's on, I often check other stations to see if something better is playing, even if I like what I'm currently playing. When I watch TV, I channel surf, often scanning through options while watching the same program. I'm a big fan of lists that try to rank things: the best movies, the best singers, the best athletes, the best novels. I never settle for second best. No matter what I do, I have the highest standards for myself. So this brings me to what I'm doing right now. Having 4 years ago hopped on a long training conveyor belt that ends up with being a doctor, I chose to temporarily hop off this year to study something else: public health, or global health. I'll explain briefly what public health or global health is for those who might not be familiar with it. Broadly, it's the study of health in populations in a global context. It's been defined as the area of study, research and practice that prioritizes health and equity for all people worldwide. It's generally seen to be about worldwide health improvement, including mental health, reducing disparities, and protecting people against global threats that disregard national borders. Now, for the few years prior to this one that was spent learning about human bodies and how to go about trying to fix them when they're not working properly, public health seemed to me like a much better return on investment. Effectively answering questions like how do we promote health and prevent disease in populations, thousands or even millions of people at a time, seemed to me to promise a solution to at least some, if not a lot, of the world's human suffering, and thus seemed like it would involve work that I'd find useful and meaningful. This brings me to the Japanese concept of ikigai. Now, this is a concept in Japan, apparently, that means a reason for being. In English, it roughly means thing that you live for, or the reason for which you wake up in the morning. Ash might be able to explain more about this later on to people who might be interested. So in secular terms, public health seems to align within the middle area for me. It seems to be a reasonable blend of something I like, something I think I'm okay at, something that I can make a living from, and something that I've seen to think that the world might need. However, it hasn't taken long for my naive expectations of what public health can do for the world to be challenged. Within the confines of classroom and book-based learning, over the last few months, I found that what the world needs, on the right-hand side there, is a lot more than improved access to things like vaccinations, safe facilities for mums and newborns, and reliable supplies of drugs to treat infectious diseases like HIV, tuberculosis, and malaria. Our world needs more than the best technologies, the best policies, the best governments, the best regulations, and the best enforcement. The extent to which our world has been corrupted by depravity, injustice, and evil demands a response that the very best and well-intentioned of human efforts simply cannot provide. We have been sent by Christ into the midst of an evil world to confront evil head-on with the power of God. So the passage today in Mark 3, thanks Tim for reading, is organized into two sections. The first, between verses 7 and 12, provides impressive evidence of Jesus' rapidly growing popularity among the people. The list of places in this passage indicates that the crowds came not only from areas that were close to Capernaum, but also from considerable distances away. In the second section, Jesus appoints the 12. The training of the 12 included not only instruction and practice in various forms of ministry, but also, first and foremost, continuous association and intimate fellowship with Jesus himself. However, Jesus does not prioritize intimacy with these 12 for their benefit alone. Their companionship with him is to lead to service that benefits others. The disciples are not merely on the receiving end of an outbreak of power, but are to become channels by which this power touches others. In other words, the 12 are created, at least in part, because God requires human cooperation to touch, enlighten, and heal others. I also think that we can learn from comparing the different groups of people that surround Jesus in these two sections of Mark 3. In particular, in appointing the 12, the call of Jesus makes a distinction between those who follow after him, desperately seeking healing, those who are only caught up in the spectacle of the seemingly strange events that take place when Jesus teaches or is ministering, and those who are summoned to follow after him as disciples with a particular task. We're told in verse 7 that a large crowd from Galilee followed Jesus as he withdrew with his disciples to the lake. It might be worth asking why so many people from so many different places came to Jesus. We know that the great crowds converged on Jesus because of what they had heard, but Mark also seems to imply that they are more interested in what Jesus does than what he says. Also, what? Why is that important for us? The unique function of Jesus, of the 12, that is not granted to others, is to be with Jesus. Mark stresses the disciples' task of being with Jesus. Discipleship, at least in the sense of belonging to Jesus' closest entourage, is not a matter of the disciples' choice, but of Jesus's. In John chapter 15, verse 16, it says, "You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you so that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, and so that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you." However, the task of being with Jesus is one that is harder than it might first appear. The 12 will have to learn that there is a difference between hanging around with him and truly being with him. The latter, truly being with him, means that they have to, that they must follow wherever he leads and share the toil of the ministry, the harassment of the crowds, and the same bitter draught of suffering. Do we know what it means to truly be with Jesus? As his disciples, do we recognize that we have been summoned to follow after Jesus with a particular purpose? Do we understand what that purpose is? In verses 14 and 15, we see that Jesus does not appoint the 12 full stop. He appoints the 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. We can see that the call is linked immediately to purpose. What does it mean that the church should do more than just talk about the power of God? It should be a community that exhibits some evidence of this power. In other words, the church should be a community that does more than just confess his name, which is no more than what the demons did. We see in verse 11 in Mark 3, whenever the impure spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." The impure spirits recognized who Jesus was, but they didn't believe in him or in his power. We have been sent by Christ into the midst of an evil world to confront evil head-on with the power of God. There's a person called David Garland, who's an American professor, who wrote one of the application commentaries that Randall gave me to help prepare for the sermon. And he writes that the church must exorcise the demons of bigotry, intolerance, parochialism or narrow-mindedness, chauvinism, racism and sexism. All the isms that imprison humankind and impel them to devote themselves to inflicting pain on others. It might be worth asking ourselves whether or not the church confronts the powers of evil today. Establishing the kingdom of God will not be effortless, but requires struggle and conflict. However, the disciples and we are promised spiritual power to engage and defeat the enemy. They and we need spiritual discernment to recognize who that enemy truly is. Now, this is not a sermon on evil or suffering per se, but briefly, worldly, fleshly, and demonic influences have in the past and continue to corrupt our world. So what does it mean that we have been sent by Christ into this world, this evil world, to confront it head on with his power? Evil is an overwhelming scourge, and the suffering it inflicts seems infinite. It can sometimes be difficult for us to fully comprehend the scale of historical tragedies. Like the first time the world witnessed the hostile use of nuclear weapons with the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on the 6th of August and 9th of August 1945, the anniversaries of these tragedies just went by last week. Could Christians, we as the church, or each of us in our metrons, have done anything about these things? Could we have done things to prevent them? Could we have done things to respond to them? What about in our everyday lives? Do we recognize opportunities to confront evil head-on with the power of God? Do we embrace opportunities to confront evil head-on with the power of God? What might evil look like in our everyday lives? At school, at work, at home, or within us? These are examples from the Australian media from just these last couple of weeks to remind us that even in what is widely regarded as one of the most successful multicultural societies in the world, racism is still alive and well in modern Australia. Is slander an evil? How do we respond when sucked into conversations that attempt to belittle or degrade others? Do we seek comfort over confrontation when we encounter evil in the world around us or within us? Has our outrage and an ability to sense evil been dulled by the fact that it's so common around us? Do we accept domains in which evil wreaks havoc as an unchangeable fact, a status quo, or are we instead angered by it and spurred into action? In Galatians 6:9, we read, "Let us not become weary in doing good, for at the proper time we will reap a harvest if we do not give up." Is our anger at evil directed appropriately? Ephesians 6:12 mentions that our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but instead against rulers, against authorities, against powers of this dark world, and against spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Although I've flicked through a few slides that point out a minuscule fraction of evil manifestations in our world, and these paint a fairly glum picture, God hasn't left us defenseless against evil. We have been given tremendous resources to confront evil head on with the power of God. Mark 6, verse 7, we have been given authority over impure spirits. And in Mark 3, verse 15, in today's passage, we have been given authority to drive out demons. In seeking to obey God and take seriously our responsibility as his disciples to extend his ministry, advance the kingdom, and push back evil, I think the following might be helpful to do. We must develop the ability to recognize our tendency to avoid conflict and confrontation and instead seek comfort. We must trust that God will equip us with the resources to confront evil when we come across it. We must ask for spiritual discernment to recognize when evil is in our midst. We must take hold of the authority and spiritual power that we've been promised to engage and defeat the enemy. And we aren't designed to deal with evil alone in our own strength. We have around us other discerning Christians. When Jesus sent out the 72 in Luke 10, verse 1, they're not set out alone, but instead two by two. As I was writing this message, I at first felt most compelled to talk about pushing back the evil around us, the evil that we come across in the world at large, and on how we've been instructed and equipped to confront this evil head on. But I think that an increased awareness of an ability to both discern and confront evil in ourselves and individually is at least equally as important. What might this look like in practice? I think applying the same steps outlined here in our own lives individually, not in a legalistic way or a salvation by works way, but in a way that prompts us to prayerfully consider how evil influences or thoughts in our own lives might hold us back from the kingdom purpose of confronting the evil that's in the world around us might be a helpful place to start. Now, these are a few questions that I thought might be good for us to think about and talk about at the moment. Maybe just based on your own experiences, thinking about what evil might look like in our lives on a basis that is for us tangible. We see on the news, as we heard in the prayers from Gemma, that you know, evil, they're full of awful stories of evil every day. Almost we read through and see things that are not very nice to see. But I suppose I was trying to ask: are there examples that are perhaps more subtle, more vague, that we perhaps maybe gloss over or don't really appreciate or accept as evil in our own lives? And then when we come across those, do we see them as chances to confront evil and use God's power to do so? And do we embrace those chances, or do we instead shy away from them or choose comfort over confrontation? Hope that was a useful... those were handy questions to talk through to get us thinking about ways we could apply this passage into our lives. So it's much easier and more common for us as Christians to retreat into a shell of comfortable Christianity. I think it's important for us to emerge with boldness and confidence from a shell like this, and to avoid temptations to retreat from the world or overlook the evil that's in our midst. We must recognize that our world's depravity cannot be overcome by human effort. What our world needs is to harness the power of God to confront evil head on. We have an exhausting array of choices available to us to tackle our world's injustice, disease, corruption, and depravity. And we, of course, need excellent education systems, fair and just legal process, excellent healthcare, benevolent world leaders, and all manner of other functioning earthly institutions. But let's not pretend that these human institutions can reclaim this world from the enemy. Let's go to the next slide. Sorry, Hashi. Yep, thanks. The choice that a maximizer would make, the best possible choice, the smart choice, is to confront evil head-on with the power of God. Apart from Randall, Rod, and Michael, a favorite preacher of mine is Tim Keller, who until recently was the pastor... No particular order. Now, Tim Keller was until recently the pastor of a church in New York City. And Tim Keller almost always manages to work into his sermons a quote by C.S. Lewis that conveys in only a line or two what he spent the best part of 40 minutes trying to communicate. Now, while I tried to resist copycatting my favorite celebrity preacher, although that label might now soon apply to Rod, since he's become in a book chapter that's about to be a bestseller, I came across a bit of C.S. Lewis that I thought was worth sharing. In his book, Mere Christianity, he writes, "Enemy-occupied territory, that is what this world is. Christianity is the story of how the rightful king has landed. You might say landed in disguise, and is calling us all to take part in a great campaign of sabotage." Despite the failures of the 12, we see throughout the Gospels that God's purposes in calling them will not be thwarted, and that God's power can still work through them to multiply Jesus' ministry. The disciples and all of us come with ignorance, weakness, and frailty. But we must learn to follow the pattern that Jesus has set out for us and take hold of the authority that we've been promised for his power to work through us to extend his ministry. We've been sent by Christ into an evil world to confront it head on with his power. Let me pray to finish. God, thank you for this passage in Mark 3. Thank you for what it teaches us and how we've been able to talk about it today. I pray that you would help us to recognize where we tend to avoid conflict and confrontation and seek comfort instead. I pray that you would help us to trust you more, to equip us with the resources to confront evil when we come across it. I pray that you would help us to ask for spiritual discernment, and that you would give us this, to recognize when evil is in our midst. I pray that you would help us to take hold of the authority and spiritual power that we've been promised to engage and defeat the enemy. And I pray that you would also help us to prayerfully consider how evil influences in our own thoughts and lives might hold us back from the purpose of confronting evil that's in the world around us. I pray that as we go out this week that we'd be able to think maybe more critically and carefully about the conversations and the interactions that we have with others and the things that we see in the world and on the news and the media, and that we might look at these maybe in a slightly different way and see them as chances to push back evil, and recognize that we've been given resources to do that. I pray that you would give us all, as we need it, the boldness and confidence to do this, and that the church would not be comfortable with only pointing out evil and recognizing it, but would be an effective vehicle to defeat it as well. So I pray these things in the powerful name of Jesus. Amen.